legislators are, which makes it almost impossible for working people to actually be able to serve in those new positions. And so there's a lot of questions that are still up in the air. But meanwhile, we have the most conservative city council that we've had in my lifetime here. And we have a city council that is not doing any kind of critical analysis about the policies they're putting in place, and B, the impact of all those resources squandered that don't lead to one new affordable housing unit in the city of Portland. And that's, and I'm even seeing that in Salem now. I see there's a bill in Salem to be moved, all these regulations so that builders can build what they want, where they want, how they want. That's not going to lead to affordable housing. I got a question for you.
Okay.
When you hear affordable housing at 80% of the area median income, what do you think that means?
I was just making gestures at you and sort of choking myself and saying, what the hell does that mean?
Well, let me tell you, that's the language that developers use, but let me unpack it for you. In order to not be cost burden in the city of Portland, an individual needs to make $26 an hour for a one-bedroom unit. Affordable housing at 80% of area median income means that you must make $72,500 to qualify for this affordable unit.
I don't make that.
Now think about that. Think about how many people would never qualify. So when you hear developers whining about being forced to add affordable units to a complex, it is absolutely insulting. So that's why those people are funding People for Portland, because I was the one every week saying, affordable for who? Right? How much money do I have to make to live there? Well, why are you calling that? Why don't you call that worker housing? Right? It's misleading to say that's affordable, because do you know what? I don't know too many people making $26 an hour. Right? So that's the pulling the veil back, right? And saying what we're doing is misleading the public. When the city of Portland says we've built 14 affordable housing units, and then I ask questions and find out, well, actually the city only owns two, and they've only put like 10,000 at most into these affordable housing units, which are at 60% of the area median income, which is really affordable for working people. But the city, they don't own them. Community nonprofits like Our Just Future, are the ones that are out there using toothpaste to put these deals together. And so to be a member of city council and have them say, well, we have these houses coming online. And then I say, well, wait a minute. I've been on this board for 14 years, and I know that the city is just one funder. It normally takes about 10 funders to put those packages together. And so so realtors and developers did not like having someone on the city council that didn't hide behind fancy words, that asked real questions and asked the impact on real people in our community. And so they put a lot of money into spending a year and a half blaming me for the housing for the homeless crisis and for the lack of police in the police bureau. Which I never had either of those in my portfolio.
right. So I just want to walk this back a little bit. Okay. You mentioned Our Just Future.
Yes.
And you're on their board.
Yes.
And they are building, I think they finished the Nick Fish building.
That's right.
And they're building another building. And these are not just affordable housing buildings. They have services.
Yes.
Services.
Right.
And a lot of the research that we've been seeing lately, actually, it's not new at all, says that the real problem with Portland, the reason that there's so many people living on the sidewalk, mm-hmm. is the confluence of the skyrocketing cost of housing,
yes.
and the lack of mental health services.
Yes.
How can you talk about who is really, in your opinion, who in government mm-hmm. is really working to change that?
Well, let me just say, Representative Bob Noss has been, at the state legislature, has been one of the biggest champions around getting adequate mental health beds. I mean, the police will even tell you someone suffering severe mental health issues, there is no place to take them. You remember when Unity's center was supposed to be the answer to people suffering mental health crisis on our streets. And the reality is they have been at capacity since the day they opened. And so I was thrilled that Multnomah County was building a mental health support center downtown Portland that had a drop-in center, had the ability for residential treatment for both men and women. And I thought, okay, this is going to help a lot. But the bottom line is mental health services have been defunded by the state for the last 30-some years.
I was going to say 30 decades, forever. Never seen it really funded.
Never seen it fully funded, right? Even though they've been under DOJ oversight at the state hospital for longer than the 12 years we've been under DOJ's settlement agreement with the Portland police. So that's the big problem. People who are suffering severe mental health issues don't have a place to go. And then we exacerbated that by decriminalizing drugs without actually providing the treatment centers that we promised as part of the process, right? And so, and then of course COVID hit, right? Which economically devastated the most vulnerable people in our community for 2.5 years. So it's a combination. Talk about a storm that was just a combination of all these factors over decades that created the conditions, and then COVID just took it over the top.
I mean, Oregon, that thing about bad mental health services, one flew over the cuckoo's nest is part of the literature.
Yes,
and
yes,
that
yes.
was, I mean, that's an Oregon story that could be, you know, seen all over the
yes.
United States.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to shift gears a tiny bit and say my day job, I work at the Northeast Coalition of Neighborhoods.
Ah.
We're going to celebrate our 50th anniversary next year.
Wow.
So I've been going through a box of historical documents and photographs.
Mm.
And one of the things that's blowing my mind about it is that virtually every single issue that we're looking at right now has not changed.
It hasn't.
So the violence against kids and
yes.
by kids,
yes.
Issues of drug abuse.
Yes.
Police
brutality.
Thank you.
Right. The lack of business opportunity.
Even
right?
garbage piles in the street.
High unemployment.
Yeah.
Among black kids, especially. Right? Yeah.
So, and this might sound esoteric, but I want to say this. As I was literally just digging through a pile of news clippings, I saw that whoever put together at this nonprofit over the, I think it was probably 15 years ago,
right.
put all the stories about drugs, youth, and guns in the same place. And I asked myself, is that valid?
Is that the real story of community? Right.
Right. And how is that changed with what's happening today?
Right.
And I was talking to our wonderful new staff person and asking her, she cares about youth, it's her issue. And she was saying, you know, you could see that when we blamed gang violence for everything, it seemed like there were adults involved in that organized crime. It seemed like it was quantified in a different way. When we look at the fentanyl crisis today, it looks a little different. But I don't even know what I think about it. I'm still trying to figure out why. How are these things different then and now?
Well,
do you think?
Those coalition officers used to work very closely with the police.
Yes, they did.
And they echoed police propaganda wherever they went. So their job was to sell police as a solution to community problems. And one of the things Commissioner Udaly did was actually do away with these, what do they call them?
School-based police officers.
No. The city council did that.
Okay.
These were neighborhood crime prevention specialists is what they called them. See, when you get old, you have to really sometimes dig deep and pull those
words.
There's
so much wisdom. It's just packed together.
But they call them neighborhood crime prevention specialists. And their job was to go to neighborhood associations and talk about the crime from a police perspective. And so they were more likely to be putting fear in the minds of white homeowners, because who goes to neighborhood association meetings? Traditionally, elderly, retired white homeowners. And who actually has the most political power? Retired white homeowners. And who's going to do what the police tell them, which is call city council and tell them we need more resources, right? So that is why they see their history through a law enforcement lens, which is why having organizations like the Coalition of Communities of Color and Latino Network and others actually bringing in real community voices is so vital, right? And you may remember the Northeast Coalition of Neighborhoods used to be the most diverse neighborhood group in the city of Portland, but that is certainly not the case today. And certainly that population has been pushed way out of inner Northeast.
One of the things that fascinates me about it is that the city of Portland is an unstable platform. And when you see, this happened at Multnomah County too. Mm-hmm. There was a citizens advisory council, mm-hmm. a citizens council involved in Multnomah County, not so different from the neighborhood associations, mm-hmm. where that citizens council that was involved in Multnomah County actually had some, they actually had a little bit of clout. Mm-hmm. And the county decided that that was legally untenable. And they shut that down, actually.
Wow.
And there's currently a lawsuit, yes. and Dan Meek, the attorney, is arguing that. I believe it's still in the court, so we haven't heard the end of it.
Right.
But Dan Meek is the attorney who shut down mm-hmm. Trojan. These things are, it's very deep conceptual mm-hmm. waters. But one of the things that fascinated me, and this is these are my words, not the words of my employers,
right.
is how the new members of the city council literally pit the community of color organizations
against each other,
the neighborhood associations, mm-hmm. and have announced they're gonna take half the money from the that they were giving to the community of color organizations and give it to the neighborhood association. But maybe they're not. But maybe they will. But maybe they not. And you can't plan for that. And this isn't anything new either.
Mm-mm.
And I think that when I look at all the photographs of NECN from the 1970s mm-hmm. and whatnot, James Loving, the first mm-hmm. executive director,
mm-hmm.
Charles Jordan, of course, he was the head
Parks
of,
director.
Right. He was the parks director, but he was also running the federal organization that actually funded and helped build some of these organizations, the Federal Model Cities Program.
That's right.
When you look at who got involved and what mm-hmm. they did, Ron Herndon, mm-hmm. all kinds of people involved, it really was people power. It really was a lot of people from the neighborhoods who mm-hmm. had a big idea, mm-hmm. From communities of color who mm-hmm. came together and did that.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, when I try to look at the bright line
mm-hmm.
between 1973 and 2023,
mm-hmm.
it's a story of just things getting unplugged
mm-hmm.
a little at a
mm-hmm.
time,
mm-hmm.
unplugged, and a lot of it is legal ruling, some of it's policy,
mm-hmm.
but just the budgeting process. Can you talk about that? What is the damage that budgets can do?
Well, let me just say that when you have a African American commissioner who sees his job as undoing all the progress that people of color have made through city council policy, it is easy for progressive white people to be very quiet. And that's what we're seeing as this budget. This should not be a conversation that only communities of color care about, because there's a reason why the city made a commitment that they, in fact, were going to fund these organizations to make sure those voices were included in public policy decisions. I have always said that the budget is a moral document. And you can say whatever you want to say, but if you follow the money, you will see where your real values lie. And so, again, having a black male be the tool of destruction allows white people to be quiet. And that is what's frustrating the heck out of me, right? Because if the neighborhood associate, like Sweeney, tried to get their money back by implying that somehow I treated them unfairly, well, you may remember the Sweeney Neighborhood Association.
Southwest Portland
Southwest,
Neighborhood Association. Coalition.
Coalition. I was the only city commissioner that was brave enough to pull their money after decades of mismanagement of public funds. And they tried to imply that I was racist against rich people, and that was why I pulled their money. Well, no, if you can actually follow the rules and these are the only dollars that you have in your nonprofit, then you're not a very effective manager of your nonprofit organization. And so it is frustrating because, again, communities of color worked hard to actually make some incremental changes. I mean, we still have 99.9% of city contracts going to white male contractors, even though we continue to aspire to do better. But it wasn't until I said, well, how many black people got contracts? How many Native Americans? How many Latinos? That I found out that it is rare for a black person to get a city contract. It is almost unseen to see an Asian Pacific Islander get a city contract. So you just go down the list and you just realize, oh, it's just white men who've been emerging for 20 and 30 years as part of the emerging small business program.
160-something years. How old is poor? Sorry, that just came out.
I got there at 167th year.
Right.
But this is with every mayor coming in, fixing the city contracting process.
If you just tuned in, we're keeping it real. I'm Lisa Loving. Our guest today, Joanne Hardesty. And you said the words rich people. Okay, I hear so many people complaining about who's living on the sidewalk, who's living in the tents,
right,
who is hanging out in the open-air fentanyl drug markets,
right,
and the property of the among the richest real estate owners in the city of Portland. And now I'm going to show what a bigot I am. I'm concerned that it's not about an influx of poor people. I'm concerned that it's about an influx of rich people. And we're seeing just a skyrocketing of property values, absentee ownership.
Yes.
My friends who run the REVEAL, the Center for Investigative Reporting in California, a couple of years ago, they tried to sue the federal government to let them see who were all of the super property buyers in the United States that were qualifying for this particular tax break.
Yes, yes.
That people who spent a lot of money, almost cursed there, a lot of money, they actually get this tax break, which I don't remember what it's called, and REVEAL lost in court. But the thing that did come out is, you know, we complain about what we can see.
That's right.
But I think that we're really, really getting hammered by the affluence that we cannot see. Can you just talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. And here's a great example. I think for most working people, when COVID hit in March of 2020, and we were forced home, and we were home for over 2 years, people opened their doors when they finally started coming outside and went, what the heck happened, right? Well, what happened in that time was there were a lot of properties developed downtown because downtown was a distressed area and got federal money for investors to actually invest money in the entire downtown. Now, there are a lot of distressed areas in the Portland metro area. Downtown would not have been the one I would have picked. But this was a Trump tax break for filthy rich people, right? So all of a sudden we wake up and it's all these brand new shiny buildings that none of us who live here today can afford to rent or lease because the rent is astronomical. And so as people start coming out and they see the rise in houselessness, apparently we forgot that we abandoned houseless people when COVID first hit. In fact, I had to make the mayor finally open the first safe villages for people who were already houseless when COVID hit. Because we opened shelters, but that was only for the people in shelters because we had to do the physical distancing, right? So people with resources forget a lot, right? So all of a sudden we're back out in society. We see the neglect on our street, and we want to blame the people who are actually the victims of our neglect for how our city looks and why it looks the way it does. I told you the city of Portland should have bought Concordia University for $5 million. They didn't. They didn't even show up on the courthouse steps to put a bid in. And we spend $40 million a year with the joint office, right? And so we now have a city council that's really more interested in sound bites than actually solving the systemic problems that didn't just show up last year or the year before. These have been problems for a long time. Salaries are not keeping up with the cost of living that is skyrocketing. As the only renter on the city council, I could tell you that my rent's going up next month, $300. And I had to decide, well, do I like pack up and move somewhere else? And I thought, well, I can't get the square footage I have for less than like $1,500 more. So I might as well pay the extra $300 a month to stay in a place that I really love living in. But until the state preempted the city's flat 5% every year rent increase, now all of a sudden, because the state legislature changed our law, now that it's tied into inflation, well, what is inflation except corporations charging much more for items to see what they can get away with? Right? That's inflation. It's like inflation isn't something that happens to us. It happens to us because corporations get greedy and they want more and more.
Just following up on that as well, the way affordable housing is subsidized by the city, these people, hedge funds, I mean, these huge corporations build quote unquote affordable housing, mm-hmm. but it's only affordable for a period of time. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that? Because I still don't understand how that works.
Oh my gosh. So, there are several programs that have expiration dates on it. So just before I was not reelected, there was an apartment complex where the residents had only lived there for a decade, but the tax break expired right. after 10 years.
Right.
And so, but the owner didn't raise taxes, but 5 years from then, he sold it to someone else. So when he sold it to the new owner, the first thing they want to do is what? Raise the rates. Maximize their profit, right? And so you had over 100 low-income, some disabled adults who were about to be evicted because they could not afford this significant rent increase that was coming.
Adding more people to the sidewalk, which yes. we were already talking about how, yeah.
Anyway, so luckily, community organizing put enough pressure, even though Commissioner Ryan takes credit for it, it was not Commissioner Ryan, it was the tenants who organized with Tenant United to actually put pressure on the new owners to actually give them like another year before he would increase the rent.
Which is only a Band-Aid
and doesn't solve the problem, right? And so that was just one example. And at that time, I was told there were six other buildings that were actually about to expire for the same reason. And so, and when I said to the mayor, well, can't we just like change it so that they can't do that? No, you can't do that after the fact. Well, then we need to change the law so that, right? Oh, no. That would not be acting in good faith. And so who is to benefit from affordable housing? I actually thought it was the residents, right, who would find a safe, warm place to be. But apparently it's the people who get to make profit off of it.
Just a great big sigh. And I feel like all of this conversation mm-hmm. is part of the built environment. I think that this mm-hmm. goes back to what mm-hmm. we're talking about. It sounds wonky to yeah. say, you know, this is urban planning. Right. And yet it is.
It is.
If it were our priority, right. we could do it differently.
Well, and if we believe that people of all income levels should be able to live all over the city of Portland, then we would build differently. I mean, once I learned that Prosper Portland's whole job is to sell public land to private interests and then beg for a public benefit, and just like we've saw with the Ritz-Carlton, you know, rich folks just say, oh, I changed my mind, right? How many times have we had rich developers promise us affordable housing, not telling us what percentage? I mean, like, what's the cutoff? Is it 80%, 60%, 50%, what, right? But just the amorphous affordable housing, and then at the end of the day, they build all the rich, fancy condos, but they don't actually build housing that working people can afford to live in, right? And because the public, you know, they hear the rhetoric that, oh, we're building but where is it? It doesn't exist in the city of Portland. And I am so fearful that a lot of people don't have anywhere else in the city of Portland to go. They're moving to Vancouver, and they're moving out of Portland because they have to for survival.
The rent is too damn high.
It's too damn high.
Just to slightly change the focus mm-hmm. now. How do you define healthy communities and cities?
A healthy community is a community where all people thrive, where there is multimodal transportation. People can get all their needs met in their community, right, within a 6-10 block radius. A healthy community is a community that actually understands that they have a wealth of resources. When I first moved here, one of the things that made me stay in Portland was because I could go and listen to live music any night of the week in different parts of the city. There were creative types that lived all over the city, right? You could build creative spaces all over the city. So you weren't tied to, if you didn't make a lot of money, you weren't tied to one geographic location. But today, I just can't imagine where creative people, where people who play music live. I can't imagine people who work in restaurants. Where do they live? Because when I kept trying to ask that question at City Hall, people would be, because guess what? Employers aren't asking that question. I do, because I'm a public transit user. So I know what it takes when you're relying on public transit. So and a healthy city has, you know, good public transit, good family wage jobs, good education opportunities, good recreation for kids, good access to trees and outdoor activity. I mean, that's a healthy community, right? And you know, we used to say we were trying to build like 10-minute communities and communities where people walked and played in their own neighborhoods, but we gave up on that some time ago, apparently.
I mean, and again, it brings me back to that whole issue of everyday people. When I read the comments of everyday people mm-hmm. in the media or in social media, I'm not saying that anyone should go to social media. Don't get me wrong.
Not today.
But we've been so easily divided and conquered. And it's easy. Wherever you go, actually, it's very much in the West.
Yes.
Not every place in the United States mm-hmm. has the same level of disparity between wealth and poverty. I was listening to, I have friends that travel. Somebody was talking about how somebody was traveling to Tennessee and they were in a rental car with an Uber car, and they were talking to the driver and they were asking, how come there's no tent communities out mm-hmm. here? And the guy laughed and said, well, it's just that it's cheaper to live here. The rents are mm-hmm. not through the roof. Mm-hmm. The property speculation alone has had such an incredible impact.
Yes.
And yet other people who are not rich mm-hmm. jump willingly onto that bandwagon mm-hmm. of, yeah, well, it's something they did, mm-hmm. and demonizing the people in the sidewalks, mm-hmm. even if it's their own kids.
But, you know, I think it's fear. You know, you can make people do things against their own best interests if you keep them in a heightened state of fear. So let's make you terrified of people that don't speak the same language you do. Let's make you terrified of people who are suffering from severe mental health issues. Let's make you terrified of people who are hungry and dancing on a city bus like in New York. And let's just make you terrified of people that don't look like you and don't have your same background. Because if we keep you terrified, you will continue to vote for more police, more aggressive removal of people that make you uncomfortable. And that's the cycle we're in right now. If you'd have told me that 4 years of Trump would have had such a long-lasting impact on the psyche of America, I would have said, no way. But what I've come to believe is that what we're experiencing are the last gasp of white male supremacy, and we're seeing it in laws being passed at state legislatures. We're seeing it in these permissive gun laws. We're seeing it where people are shooting 14-year-olds in their driveway because they got into a wrong car. I mean, it's like, so we're in this state of, but as long as you are in fear, you aren't calm enough to realize the insanity of your actions because you're just operating from fear. It takes a little bit more to actually have a conversation with a houseless person. It takes a little more to actually try to understand, but for grace, I could be living in a tent right now, right? It takes like not just being in a constant state of fear and expecting immediate solutions to problems that we created over decades. And so we have Commissioner Mapps is an expert at just speaking in sound bites, and he has no, as a college professor, I'm really disappointed that he never does his homework, but he just finds a soundbite and off he goes. You have Gonzalez that I still believe has never read the settlement agreement between the Department of Justice and the city of Portland, because you wouldn't think that police are the solution to people suffering mental health crisis or housing, a lack of housing stability. You would not think that more police is the only solution to the problems that the city of Portland has. And I just don't want to say anything about Wheeler, because, you know, Wheeler is Wheeler. And I see a city council that is bending over backwards to support people who don't have the general public at goodwill at heart. And when I say that, I mean those very rich people that run the Portland Business Alliance, that are paying Kevin Looper and the other dude, I hate even saying Looper's name, because he's been a traitor, because he has made his entire fortune off of working on behalf of progressive efforts. And the only reason I think he did People for Portland is because he wanted to work for Betsy Johnson's campaign. And talk about hired guns, he didn't care if she won or not, as long as he got paid. And so he continues to get paid through this People for Portland. And you can see with the big billboard, they're coming after District Attorney Mike Smith, just like they did me, just like they did Vega Peterson.
Chloe Daly, I think, too.
Well, they didn't exist when you Daly was in office.
She was sort of, I do think, and it's, I mean, I think she was kind of targeted and ousted, too. It wasn't specifically Portland's, you know, that group, but yeah.
Well, the fact that these two men are being paid by rich property owners to misconstrue the public into believing that somehow their solution that they develop behind closed doors is a better one. What I find more, and you know, and rich people can do what they want with their money. What I find more appalling is that we have a city council that is bending over backwards to actually respond to them in this PR campaign, rather than the hundreds and thousands of people in the city who desperately need leadership from the city council.
If you just tuned in, we are keeping it real. I'm Lisa Loving. Our guest is Joanne Hardesty here in the studio. This is a heartbreaking one. This is a really heavy emotional one. What happened to Portland Street Response?
Well, let me just say that I believe Commissioner Gonzalez's sole mission is to undo all the great work that's been done to create, pilot, and then expand citywide Portland Street Response. And the reality is that, as you know, when he took office, he put a hiring freeze on. But this is when you know you have someone who doesn't understand the political moment that we're in. I was actually able to get 80% of staffing costs for Portland Street Response paid for by the reimbursed by the federal government in partnership with U.S. Senator Ron Wyden. He and I worked 2 years solid to change change how Oregon Health Authority reimbursed for medical expenses in the city of Portland. It took us 2 years to make that change happen. And so what Gonzalez is doing is actually stupid, because Portland Street Response has very little impact on the city's general fund. I intentionally did not create a program, because I know programs come and go based on who's in office, which is why I made Portland Street Response part of the 911 response system. When I read that they want Portland Street Response to be on standby to help with sweeps, I think to myself, well, who's going to answer the 911 call? Because they are connected to 911. They are not supporters of police and fire to go sweep homeless people from camps. Unless somebody is suffering a severe mental health issue and there's a 911 call seeking their assistance. So we have someone who, A, doesn't believe in the program, doesn't know enough about the program, and is a little too arrogant to actually learn how it's benefiting thousands of Portlanders every single day. But my hope is I know that Chief Boone, Chief Sarah Boone, the fire chief, is 110% committed to our vision, the vision that we developed from the ground up. And as long as she's there, I have hope that Portland Street Response will continue to provide quality service in spite of what the higher-ups try to dictate and try to change.
All right. We're starting to run out of show. I want to shift gears a little bit. For people who really do share that vision of how of what a healthy community is, mm-hmm. where should they be plugging in to participate in our city and making it better right now?
Oof. I think they should be paying attention to these 12 new city council seats that are coming up in November of 2024. I think people who are committed to community should be thinking now about putting together their own campaigns in their own neighborhood. Because honestly, if community organizing is happening now to make sure that the people are represented on this new city council, to me, I think that's like the best thing that people can do right today is start talking to your neighbors. Who do you want to see? Who do you want to recruit? Maybe it's you. Maybe it's somebody you know, right? Maybe it's somebody that just needs some urging and some support. There will be campaign schools this summer, which I would encourage people to keep an eye out for. And as soon as I get the flyers, when they're completed, I'll make sure that Cable sends it out as announcements. But it's really important for people to continue to educate themselves about these really core issues. I got to tell you, we have about $5 billion in transportation money coming down the pike in the next decade. And if we don't have the right leadership, all we're going to be doing is expanding roads and more car congestion. We're not going to be imagining a city where everyone gets to be mobile, regardless of how they get around, or whether that's rolling, or whether that is walking, or whether it's using an assistance device.
All right, follow-up question.
All right.
Where do you go for the best news and information on what's going on in our city? I know that's a big question a lot of people have.
That is a big question. And honestly, I try to compare articles, right? Right now, for me, OPB seems to do like the best job.
Alex Zielinski, their City Hall reporter.
Yeah. You know, and Sophie, I got to say, Sophie with Willamette Week, even though I had to check her.
Sophie Peel, yeah.
I had to check her on how she would address or respond to me around the neighborhood associations, because Chloe and I were not the same in how we handle those. But I reach out to her and say, look, would you just stop putting both of us in the same sentence, and actually gave her, I printed out four articles. These are some of the things I did when I had this office in my portfolio. So please, right? So I what's lacking, and that's one of the things I loved about you, Lisa, when I could read you every week, was that you do investigative reporting. You don't just take somebody's press release and then print it as if it's fact. You actually go out and talk to people. You're on the ground. You're talking to people in their community, right, from their perspective.
I wish there was more of that.
We need more of that, because your Oregonian fails miserably on that. They just print press releases and whatever they think will make them money. It's embarrassing to say they're supposedly out daily.
I wish that there was just more coverage of activist organizations and activist movements, because there are so many things that are just festering in the city. And actually, mm-hmm. there are people working on them, but you don't read about it.
That's right. Well, because it's not news. If right. it doesn't bleed.
Right. That is more true than ever. Okay. Yes. Okay. Here's my last question. Right. This is a really hard one.
Okay.
And you don't have to answer it if you don't want to. But what can you share your future plans?
At the moment, I am in my happy place. I am living my best life, and I am not making any permanent long-term plans. Everything I'm working on now is like a year project or so, and then we'll just see.
All right. Okay, that's it for our show. Joanne Hardesty, thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
This is Keeping It Real with Lisa Loving. And special thanks to KBOO Public Affairs Director Ender Black and Program Director Asia Hawthorne for making all of this possible. KBOO Radio is reemerging. Get involved by emailing volunteer@kboo.org. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Hey.
KBOO. And next, audio submissions for Love Your Pet Week.
My furry little baby's name is Fergie. He's a Persian cat who is 8 years old. We first met when I saw him on Craigslist, and I thought it was a total scam because of how cute he is. But fortunately, it was not a scam. I showed up at the place, gave them $150 as my adoption fee, and we have been together for over 2 years. I love him with my whole heart. He is sweet. He is gentle. He is extremely loving, and he is extremely fearful of the other cat we live with. He is definitely a baby. As far as lessons I have learned from Fergie, I've definitely learned to take a lot of patience and time to care for the things that I love. It is a lot of maintenance to take care of a long-haired Persian, and I do have to set aside time every single day to ensure that he's groomed, that his face is wiped, that he has his special little food topped off in his special little bowl in the exact special little way he wants, because he is a prissy little guy. And I hope he's learned that he is extremely loved and worshipped by all those he shows his presence to. Some of my most memorable times living with Fergie have definitely been getting him all sorts of dressed up and dolled up for any time we have people over. I know it's not every person's thing to dress up their pet, and it's not every pet's thing to get dressed up, but he is kind of wholeheartedly a fan of it. His favorite things to wear are bows on his neck and tail. He also enjoys a good turtleneck in the chilly seasons. While Fergie is definitely alive and well, I did have an interesting experience when I first got him, wherein I realized the back of him looked exactly like my childhood pet. And I stared at him and I looked into his eyes, and I really felt that this person, this kitten in front of me, I guess he's kind of an old man, was the reincarnation of my childhood cat, and I felt like I was talking to her through him.
Hey, what's up, everyone? It's Greg McVicker, creator of Undercurrents, and this is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
Thank you for tuning into KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign.